This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The number of hunting licenses being sold in Vermont has been on the decline over the last few decades, mirroring a trend seen in many states around the country. License fees account for a significant portion of the budget for fish and wildlife departments around the country. So the declining numbers of hunters negatively impact those budgets, and fee increases can't keep pace with the increasing costs of research and enforcement. Hunters can no longer be relied on as the main funding source for research into things like chronic wasting disease in deer, or to cover all the costs of the state game wardens who enforce wildlife regulations around the state. Vermont wildlife and government officials are looking at changing the funding model to include everyone who uses the outdoors. But an attempt to attach a registration fee on the purchase of kayaks and canoes a few years ago was not well received. So what is the right approach? We're going to take a look at what Vermont Fish and Wildlife is thinking, and we'll explore how other states are trying to adapt to the new landscape. I'm joined in the studio now by wildlife biologist Kim Royer. She's special assistant to the commissioner at Vermont's Department of Fish and Wildlife, and by Matt Crawford, former outdoors editor with the Burlington Free Press, who now works for a PR firm that specializes in the outdoor and adventure industry. Kim and Matt, nice to have both of you back on the program.
Thank you very much, Jane.
Thanks for having us.
I want to get into what the tension is here, just to state this issue. What is the actual problem that we're dealing with? Declining hunting, especially hunting licenses, fishing licenses, I think, tend to stay pretty steady, but declining numbers of hunters buying licenses. The Fish and Wildlife Department has increased the fees. So actually, Vermont Fish and Wildlife is making about the same amount of money on fewer hunters than it was 10 years ago. So what's the problem here when it comes to how we're actually funding what Fish and Wildlife is doing, Kim Royer?
Sure. Probably should start out by saying that right now we're still in pretty good shape, and we're in good shape by the good graces of the legislature, the administration, and the governor, who for the last 5 years have been filling the gap between what hunters and anglers and trappers have been able to provide in revenues and what we have not been able to have over the last 5 years or so. So they have basically appropriated about $5 million annually to fill that gap. So what we're trying to do right now is be proactive in the way we approach our budget, because we know we can see this problem on the horizon. So just to start out, our mission is a very broad mission. It's the conservation of fish, wildlife, plants, and their habitats for the people of Vermont. And many non-hunters and non-anglers don't understand that that mission for the last 80 years up until recently has been funded primarily and almost exclusively by hunters and anglers. And so, you know, we're very interested in making sure that the general public gets invested in this mission as well, because there are lots of benefits to the general public in the implementation of this mission. It really contributes to our quality of life in Vermont. It contributes to the health and well-being of our children and our grandchildren, and it actually contributes to the resiliency of our economy. So what's happened over the last 80 years is that we have had this hunting and fishing base of people who have bought licenses, and actually there's also been a tax on hunting and fishing equipment that goes through the federal government and gets apportioned to the states according to a formula.
And ammunition and other
ammunition,
guns,
exactly. And the combination of those two things have actually been what's funded fish and wildlife agencies across the country. But basically, this is a demographic problem and not a participation problem. The baby boomers have sort of been the base of our funding. And we have a peak population between the ages of 42 and about 70 that have funded fish and wildlife agencies across the country. But as those baby boomers age, they're actually going to fall out of the sport. And the population that's coming up behind is not going to be large enough to provide the same sorts of funding that that particular cohort was able to provide. And so we see this coming, and fish and wildlife agencies across the country see it coming, and we're trying to figure out how are we going to deal with this in the future.
Matt Crawford, maybe you could help illuminate as well what it actually is that Fish and Wildlife Departments, Vermont's and others are doing, because one thought might be, well, fine, just have fewer game wardens if there are fewer hunters and fewer things that Fish and Wildlife Departments are doing related to hunting and fishing, and you're fine. You shrink the budget, shrink what you're doing, and no problem.
Right. So when Kim said that participation was part of the problem, I thought that this is not necessarily part of the problem, but part of the issue is that the scope of Fish and Wildlife agencies across the United States have expanded dramatically. So the North American conservation model started with basically Teddy Roosevelt and Hunter saying, yeah, this is what we want to protect and this is why. Rightfully so, when we employ skilled biologists who've been trained for this kind of stuff and ecologists and all these kind of folks who can help with species beyond just game animals, the expansion of the duties of Fish and Wildlife have expanded vastly. And so when Kim is talking about some of the duties they do in managing game species and non-game species, there's also, and I think maybe a misunderstanding by some of the businesses in this state, the role that Fish and Wildlife plays. For instance, I want to put up wind towers on my ridgeline. I've got to go through this 240A process. I need to have clearance from Fish and Wildlife. And Kim, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think wind developers pay for your expertise on that.
There's bill back for big projects, but other than that, no.
Ski areas, which are on state or federal lands, most by and large, oftentimes the lead on search and rescue missions for ski areas for folks who ski out of bounds are done by our wardens. There's no bill back, and there's no small tax, let's say, on lift tickets that helps offset that cost, right?
That's correct.
So we've...
Or, for example, if you've got a bat in your home and you need to call somebody, you're going to call a warden. Or if you're not following the regulations and you're out in your boat, not hunting or trapping, but you're just doing something wrong, it may be a warden who's enforcing boating laws. Or you may be using an access point for your kayak or canoe or your boat that's managed by Fish and Wildlife.
Or you want to preserve a wetland not just for ducks and geese, but for herons and bullfrogs and salamanders. I mean, all that stuff is now under the purview of Fish and Wildlife with no real money source to fund it.
Right. Things like invasive species have become a big issue that we're dealing with. Conflicts, human-wildlife conflicts. You have a moose in town that has to be dealt with by our law enforcement staff. Rabies vector species and dealing with that is our law enforcement staff. So there is a whole host of new duties besides the fact that there's like 440 plus birds, mammals, fish, and reptiles and amphibians, and 20,000 invertebrates that we're supposed to be making sure that there's a sustainable population into the future. So
it's not a situation where you can say fewer hunters and fisher people means less for the department to do. That is not a future you see.
No, in fact, it could actually be the opposite, because many of our hunters and trappers actually do some of the work for us, in that if we have a nuisance bear in a cornfield, we'll have a houndsman come in and actually chase that bear so that we don't have to do that and we don't end up having to put that bear down. So we have population controls that are handled by our hunting population. And if they were not there, we'd have a lot more human-wildlife conflicts.
Okay, so we've established some of what the Fish and Wildlife Department does. Listeners, I'd like to invite you into this conversation. How should we fund it? How should we pay for those activities? And what would you be willing to pay? Do you see something like an excise tax on recreation equipment working? Do you see some other tax that everybody pays as being fair, equitable, a realistic way to pay for fish and wildlife conservation, research, and law enforcement? What is it that you would actually do, or are there voluntary programs that you think could work and would actually help funding, things like the STAMP programs that are already out there? Let us know what you think. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Now, we should say the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department for this fiscal year has a budget of $24 million. That sounds like a lot of money.
It does.
And it sounds like, Kim Royer, you're saying that's fine. You're actually able to do what you need to do right now with that budget. It's more the future that you're worried about.
That's true. And then there's fixed costs that go up annually, things like healthcare costs, cost of living costs, fee for space, pilot payments for land that we own, tax payments, payments in lieu of taxes. So these fixed costs actually go up as well. Even if we stay static in terms of the number of staff that we have, we know that our costs are going to go up. And so trying to figure out how are we going to close that gap with a declining revenue base and an increase in cost is really the challenge.
But Matt Crawford, as I said, looking at the figures from 10 years ago and the figures for now, it looks like the Fish and Wildlife Department in Vermont is actually still making the same amount of money off fewer hunters. So why not just keep jacking up the fees? I mean, I'm not hearing cost as a major complaint among hunters in Vermont.
I don't think the shortfall is being made up with fees. I think it's being made up with a general appropriation from the budget. And to be honest, giving credit where credit is due, until Governor Shumlin was in office, that wasn't really part of the discussion. It sort of came to a head under Douglas, and there were a couple of study groups to look at how we're going to fund Fish and Wildlife. And I think the Douglas administration did, and the legislature at that time, did fund the department to a small amount, right, Kim? I mean,
that's true.
But really, once Peter Shumlin took office, the dip into the general fund has been greater. And, you know, let's be honest, everything, you know, we don't have an endless supply of money in Vermont, obviously. And so everything that comes to Fish and Wildlife is not going somewhere else. I mean, you look at, you know, health services and human services and some of the other programs that maybe are in a crisis situation in the state, it can be hard to sit across the table and say, well, we're taking it from you and giving it to Fish and Wildlife.
So right. That's what you're talking about in the general fund, why it may be unpalatable to people to increase money from the general fund. But what about that question of just make hunting fees, double them, and then you get more revenue?
Well, every time, and Kim and I were talking about this before you came in, every time that Fish and Wildlife has imposed a fee on or increase on fee on licenses, whether that's increase in the archery tag or an added bear tag or whatever it is, you see a decline in hunting sales the next year.
Right. We actually, in 1991, I think, we increased fishing license fees by $5 and went from something like 60,000 licenses sold to 47,000 the following year. So you can price people right out of the market, and that's something we don't want to do. We want to encourage as many people to participate in hunting, fishing, and trapping as possible.
Let me ask you both, and Matt, I'll let you jump back in here, but let me ask you both a pointed question on that. Is the department now trying to encourage people to hunt? I know it is. The department does want to get more people into hunting. There's Youth Hunting Weekend that's designed to get more young people hunting. There have been projects that are designed to get more women hunting and fishing. So clearly the department is trying to reach out to new demographics. Is the wildlife management plan being negatively impacted on a scientific level, or is the best science not being followed in order to get more people hunting so that the department can get more fees? I'm going to ask you, Kim, because you work for the department, but Matt, I'd like your take as well, since you're not.
Right, and we get that question quite regularly. We do not base any of our biological decisions on how many licenses we're going to sell. Our biological decisions are based purely on what's in the best interest of the resource. So that being said, I think that your question about whether or not we spend, what was your question, Jane, about?
This one is, are you making decisions that are in the best interest of the animal populations, or are you trying to basically build more revenue on the backs of those
right.
animals?
Yes. And so we are trying to recruit more hunters to backfill that bubble that's getting older. But we also know that no matter how much effort we put into recruitment, we just don't have the population to actually fill that gap.
Matt Crawford, what do you think? Because there was a perception recently when Fish and Wildlife was changing some regulations around hunting deer specifically, that there was a perception among some hunters that this was based on trying to get more people hunting rather than what's best for the current hunters or what's best for the animals.
I think that's true. I think that anytime there's a change in regulations, there's especially with deer, mm-hmm. there tends to be it tends to boil really quickly and all things get thrown against the wall. But I will say that I think that Fish and Wildlife has actually been more over the years when I was covering them for the Free Press and now sort of as an outsider. What I see now is the Fish and Wildlife Department being actually more focused on its scientific mission and using science a lot more than it did 25 years ago or so. And to follow up on that, I do know that Fish and Wildlife is working on these retention or these recruitment issues for hunters. So you look at the numbers and you're like, are they doing a really bad job or are they doing a really good job in keeping it where it is? Because you look at the numbers, I was sent this today. The number of hunting licenses sold in 2014 is an all-time low, 70,371. And in 2004, for instance, that was 85,000. We lost 15,000 people in 10 years buying hunting licenses. So now the question is, did we not do a good job in recruiting those people back to it? Or did we just hold, is that really good because it would have been even deeper without any effort?
And what's your take?
I don't know how much more a department can do. I really don't.
Yeah, there's a lot of effort with partners to try to encourage recruitment of, just like you were saying, of women and youth and come up with mentors to help people. But again, I think it's really a demographic issue. I mean, we are seeing this human population getting older, and no matter what we do, we are going to lose a certain percentage of those people every single year.
We're talking today about how to fund conservation efforts that are run through the state Fish and Wildlife Department and how to basically pay for everything that Fish and Wildlife is required to do and has been tasked with doing. Coming up, we're going to hear from some of you about what you'd be willing to pay, how you think the department could change the model and fund itself. So if you have a thought on that, again, call 1-800-639-2211 or post thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We're going to get to your suggestions coming up next. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're exploring the future of state conservation efforts and wildlife protection and how to pay for it. The Fish and Wildlife Department does a lot of work in this area, as well as regulating hunting and fishing. We're finding out where the department gets its funding and why Vermont's department and others around the country are feeling the pressure to find a new model to pay for their work. Kim Royer with the department is one of our guests today, and Matt Crawford, who used to be an outdoors editor with the Free Press and now works for a PR firm that specializes in these areas, is also joining us. And we have a lot of you who want to add your thoughts to the mix. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. If you can't get through on the phone line, you can also post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to Jason calling in from Burlington. Hi, Jason. Go ahead.
How's it going today?
Great.
Hey, so I just wanted to make a comment. It seems to me in this day and age that our environment and our wildlife should be our number one priority. Regardless if we get time off to go enjoy the outdoors or take a hike after work, it just seems to me that we should implement a tax, because it affects everybody. The service isn't just a recreational service. It's also a service, an emergency service. Let's say the person who works 70 hours is... Are you there?
Yeah, we're listening. The person who works 70 hours is?
Yeah, the person who works 70 hours doesn't get to go for a hike, but yet when he comes home, there's a bear going through his trash. He still has to call that same service.
Yeah.
You see the point I'm trying to make?
So, Jason, yes, and how would you institute that tax? Would you make it a sales tax, an excise tax on certain products? What would you do?
I would make it I would just make it a tax, just like your land tax, a residency tax. I don't know. If you live in the state of Vermont, it affects you.
Yeah, Jason, thanks for your thoughts. I appreciate that. I'm going to pair it with an email we got from Rick, who says, why not require an annual sticker purchase, just like with cars? I would happily register my kayak, but I would want something in return. Today's weather is beautiful, but I can't go kayaking for fear of getting shot. If I pay registration, I would want certain areas designated off limits to hunting so I can go hiking and kayaking without worry. And Noggle Tonal says, wildlife conservation dollars to support research and management should come from all who enjoy the outdoors and wildlife. Fish and Wildlife should also increase the presence of wildlife advocates on their board. But this poster also says that he thinks wildlife management is sometimes a euphemism for hunting and trapping. And like Rick, wants some changes. He says conservation should not be based on the needs or wants of trophy hunting and trapping, but on ethical, neutral, and sound science and research. Would we donate to support Fish and Wildlife conservation if it continued trophy hunting and trapping in the state? Absolutely. If it discontinued those, at least our kayak fees would be for a good reason, to support the biodiversity and sustainability of our land and wildlife for all who enjoy it on a kayak, a hike with a camera, a paintbrush, or a snowshoe. So some competing interests here, but people who are saying, I'm willing to pay for it, but I got to be able to use it. I think right now it's mostly just turkey hunters who are out there, so probably not a problem if you're going out in your kayak.
Waterfowl hunters are out there.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So what about that, Matt?
Well, there's a lot there.
Yeah.
and I sort of fall back on some work we did 4 or 5 years ago with the Vermont Wildlife Partnership, which was a coalition put together really on by the strength of the folks at the Nature Conservancy in Vermont and the Wildlife Federation, NWF. And we put together a group of people, and George Gay at NWF was really pushing it then, called the Vermont Wildlife Partnership, that was advocating for 1/8 of a cent of the sales tax to be allocated to Vermont Fish and Wildlife. And that sort of gets to Jason's point about a tax. It's also sort of much more broad-based than anything else we have. And it's a model that's done in other states. Missouri does it, for instance. They take 1/8 of 1% of their sales tax, or 1/8 of 1 cent, and they dedicate it to Fish and Wildlife or their Fish and Wildlife agencies and fund it that way. So there is a way around that. There is a way to sort of give rise to those voices who may not be represented and paying through that arena.
Does it then have to change the way and the ability for hunters to do what they do? Because you see this, you often see this tension between recreationers who either don't hunt or don't support hunting and hunters.
Well, the truth of the matter, that ship has left the harbor. I mean, Fish and Wildlife is already funded in a lot of its projects not by hunters, right? So to say, oh, it's being done for hunting or done for sportsmen, that's really not the case. I mean, you can look at a bunch of federal programs. You can look at the general fund already. Really, that's already out. That's gone. That's long gone.
And I think I would add that the future of conservation is too critical for people who care about the resources to quibble and to have conflicts. And we really need to look at ways to work together, because in general, we all have the same concerns. And really, it's such a pleasure to work in a state like Vermont, where we get this kind of support for wildlife conservation, regardless of whether you're a hunter, a trapper, or just a recreationist. I mean, people in Vermont care about wildlife.
Well, and in fact, you have statistics on that. Didn't Fish and Wildlife do a survey to find out what people thought about that, both hunters and fisher people and non?
We did. We actually did a survey in June and July of this past year, and it was a trend survey, so we could measure trends from previous surveys. And things like threatened and endangered species, I mean, there's 81% of the public supports protection of threatened and endangered species. 86% of hunters and anglers support protection of endangered species. There's a lot of commonality there, and we really need to look for that commonality and move forward on the bigger mission of conservation.
So what about some of these ideas of taxes that we could try, either a really broad-based tax or an excise tax on things? We got a note from Bob who says, lots of recreational boaters use Fish and Wildlife fishing access areas. Maybe fishing licenses could come with a sticker, which would be required to park at these fishing access areas. So lots of ideas for, you know, things like that you could charge.
That's kind of in place, right, Kim? I mean, a percentage of the gas tax goes back to Fish and Wildlife, and boater registration, a percentage goes back to Fish and Wildlife.
That is correct. 15% of the federal dollars go to fishing access areas. So motorboat owners pay for those fishing access areas. Fishermen pay for those fishing access areas. Interestingly enough, kayakers and canoeists are not paying for them right now, and they are allowed to use them. So, you know, there is an option there, although in this survey we gave the callers 5 choices in terms of what kinds of funding they might support. And as you suggested in your promotion, the stamp on kayaks and canoes is still the lowest option. And in fact, the 1/8 of 1%, 61% of the public supports that particular funding option, which was a surprise to us.
That's the Missouri model that Matt referenced.
And it's working in other states.
Right.
I mean,
let's go to Scott, who's calling in from Colchester. Scott, what would you be willing to contribute?
Yeah, part of alternative recreational users, kayakers, sailors, et cetera, who actually aren't paying boat registration fees. But I know one of your one of the people on your panel right now actually just mentioned that, you know, kayakers are not paying fees and do have access to fish and game points. But there are an order of priorities to fish and game access points. Years ago, we tried to actually, you know, bump up our priority. We were getting kicked out of fish and wildlife access points. And we tried to say, hey, we'll buy fishing licenses. And they said no. And we I'm actually part of a kiteboarding community.
I see. So that's the kiteboarders?
Yeah. So there's an order of priority of fish and wildlife access points. Number one's fishers and hunters. Second is registered boats, sailboats, motorboats. Third is kayakers and whatnot. And then there's sort of like a fourth page, which is like, you know, sort of banned or like last consideration. So we'd love to contribute and love to be part of the community. But this order of priorities, which gives fishermen, you know, absolute seniority to access points is kind of offensive and doesn't work with the current model that's happening with Vermont's recreational habits and changes that have happened in the last 50, 100 years, whatever.
Scott, thanks for your comments. Let's get another in here from Walter in Derby before we toss it back to our guests. Hi, Walter. What are you thinking about?
Well, my sense is that before we talk about taxes, there really is a structural issue that really hasn't been addressed or it's been touched on very lightly. And I think that's the fact that wildlife decisions are made by a citizens board. Appointments that are most of the recommendations come through the department to the governor, and then their folks are added to the board. And again, this body, not the department, but this group of citizens, makes decisions about wildlife that everyone in the state cares for: bear, moose, deer, fox, coyotes, bobcat. All of those decisions, and certainly hundreds of other species, go through the board. And yet, the public at large is excluded from a seat at the table. And in other words, the representatives of the hunting faction, trapping faction, fishing faction are included on that board. But again, the general public is not included. And yet the state statutes are very clear that public or wildlife is to be managed for the public good.
Walter, I'm going to stop you there because I hear what you're saying and take your point, and we can pair that with Scott. And Matt Crawford, I know you're edging in here. You want to talk about
just one quick thing. The Fish and Wildlife Board, however, makes the decisions almost entirely on game species. So the vast majority of work that the Fish and Wildlife Department is doing on non-game species, which is, you could argue, as critical or more critical, there is no board of sportsmen steering that. So,
nonetheless, if the priorities are being set by people whose interest is in hunting and fishing, then that is going to change, you know, to Scott's point about access and who gets priorities.
There is an endangered species committee that does set priorities for threatened and endangered species, and we have a wildlife action plan that sets priorities for species of greatest conservation need. And as Matt suggested, the Fish and Wildlife Board sets regulations pertaining to hunting and fishing. And I just wanted to say to Scott's point that I appreciate his comments. We'd love to have a discussion about this. The priorities are set by federal statute, but you know, if we had another funding source, perhaps we could consider alternatives to access for canoes and kayaks.
And Matt Crawford, for you, bottom line, should we go to the Missouri model, that 1/8 of 1 cent tax?
I think absolutely, or something like that. Some sort of broad-based tax that would fund fish and wildlife and be not really hurt people in the pockets.
Kim Royer, can we see a proposal like that coming out of Fish and Wildlife anytime soon?
I think that will take a lot of work with partners and with the administration, but it is one of the things that we'll be looking at.
Kim Royer is Special Assistant to the Commissioner of the Vermont Department of Fish and Wildlife. She's also a wildlife biologist. Thanks for being on the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Matt Crawford works for the PR firm Pale Morning Media, which specializes in the outdoor industry. Matt, nice to have you here again.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we'll talk with the superintendent of the Franklin West Supervisory Union. He has bold ideas about the kind of experience he wants for kids.
The thing that I always try to talk about in our schools is school has to be joyful. School has to be fun. And a lot of times we do our best not to make it either. And, you know, you watch kindergartners and first graders every day. They run into school. I love it, you know. But when kids are in high school, they run out of school. And somewhere along the line, it stops being joyful. They stop being able to dream, and it turns into something they don't want it to be.
That's ahead on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The Franklin West Supervisory Union includes three rural towns in northwestern Vermont: Fletcher, Fairfax, and Georgia. But don't mistake rural schools to mean schools that are technologically behind the curve. The superintendent of Franklin West has championed technological innovation so much that the district was recently named to the League of Innovative Schools, a national organization that brings public education leaders together to share research, thinking, and approaches to teaching. Franklin West is the only school district in all of New England to be accepted into the league, which, as Superintendent Ned Kirsch explained to us, is not what it might sound like.
Well, it's not a superhero league, even though that does sound really cool. It's not the League of Justice or the Justice League. What it is, it's fairly new, and it's a league that was developed by an act of Congress, actually, and it is through the Department of Education in Washington, and they've partnered with Digital Promise to bring together like-minded school districts from around the country to spur innovation in schools. And we are accepted into the third class. We are one of 77 school districts in the country that are part of the league.
What made Franklin West qualified to be considered an innovative school district?
We know we live in a digital world, and we've really tried to structure our schools around our students living in a digital culture. If you close your eyes and go into a school, it's not that different than it was 100 years ago. A lot of times students will come into school and have to power down from their life outside of school, where it's a rich environment. And we really wanted to make our environment like that as well. We started down the road to one-to-one technology with our students 4 years ago.
That's one-to-one technology, like one-to-one laptop or iPad or something?
We use iPads. And we started that 4 years ago in the middle school at Bellows Free Academy, Fairfax. And we've since branched out. So now our schools, like Fletcher Elementary School, has iPads in grades 3, 4, 5, and 6. BFA grades 4 through 12 at Georgia Elementary Middle School. It begins in the sixth grade, but we have lots of carts and technology in all the classrooms, starting in pre-K all the way up. So, you know, we really think that that's an important part of learning, is being able to access the most current information available. An iPad, we went that route for a few reasons. What I like most about it is that when you're using an iPad, you usually mobile, or you're in a flexible learning environment. To me, that's huge for schools, is that we have to have our students not sitting in desks. We have to have them moving and experiencing, and that's really what the iPad, I think, brings to education.
You mentioned that flexible learning environment, and that's actually one of four targets that you have in your supervisory union. And the targets are personalized learning, working on leadership, working on flexible learning environments, and community engagement is the fourth target. Why are those the four pillars of your plan?
Well, about 5 years ago, we had to complete a technology plan for the state. We also had to then complete an action plan for the state, and they didn't mesh. And it was born out of that discussion that we came up with those four pillars. So those four pillars kind of exposed themselves. And if you think about it, personalized learning, leadership, flexible learning environments, community partners, or engagement, if every student is working on those four areas, we're going to have some fabulous students. I mean, they really go to every part of education.
So students are working on leadership. It's not school leadership in the form of teachers, and students are working on community engagement?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that student leadership is critical. At BFA High School, I know that we have an athletic council, and that's just one little tiny example. But, you know, it's been wonderful to watch our students step forward and become leaders. We have two students who are presenting at a conference soon based on their leadership. We have students who were out in San Francisco last year presenting at an EPSCoR, which is a science conference. You know, leadership takes many forms, and the more that we can have our students become leaders, I think the better it is for our communities.
Tell me a couple of examples from another one of the targets, the flexible learning environments, and how you work on that within the school system.
Again, I think that you have to look at what students are doing, where they're doing it. You know, they don't have to be sitting in their classroom. They can be in a river. They can be working virtually. You know, high school kids could be working with a group of third graders. And I think that's a piece we often miss in schools. You know, we want schools to produce students that are ready to take over the world. But we have an environment that's a little contrived, but then we hope that they'll figure out how to do this stuff once they leave school. We want school to be like the communities we live in. We want students to experience education that will be relevant as soon as they walk out the door.
So are they doing that already? Do you have outdoor education that is studying ecology in a river, or students who are working at the high school level with elementary school kids?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We actually have a group of students who we're hoping that will be going to Puerto Rico later in the year. They've been working with a school and some students in Puerto Rico virtually. Part of that study is could be going down there and actually do some real field research with them, because we're really also trying to expose our students to the global world, because we know that that's who not only they could be competing with in the future, but just working with in the future. So, you know, I'm really proud of the work that our teachers do around global education. You know, we have students in fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade, seventh grade, in all of our schools, speaking with schools in other parts of the world, and not just like a one-time deal. We work with this group, the IVECA program, which is International Virtual Education. And, for example, we have a fourth-grade classroom spending about 6 weeks working with a school in Argentina where they're sharing information, getting to know about each other's culture, learning about the concept of intercultural competence. And then at the end of the six-week period, they're going to have a live class via our video conferencing. And to me, you know, starting that in fourth grade, having students understand that concept of there's other people in the world and they're like me and we're going to need to work together in the future, to me, that's one of the biggest concepts that we can have our students learn, because it's reality right now. You know, it's not – it's a must-have at this point.
Who translates that?
Well, oddly enough, all the schools that we work with – all speak English. They know more than one language. You know, I think it's
amazing.
It's an eye-opening piece for our students as well as our teachers. You know, we work with schools in Korea. They're all bilingual in fourth grade. I think it really blows our students away.
Do you feel like you're empowered by both Vermont law and supported by the agency of education to do what you want for your students in these realms that we've been talking about?
Empowered, yeah. Act 77, I mean, is so similar to our action plan, and we were working on our action plan before Act 77, which is kind of cool. But yeah, I think we have a lot of advantages in Vermont, and speaking to other superintendents from the league, they don't have those advantages. They are very tied into what the Department of Ed says goes, you know, and we're allowed to be creative. We're allowed to be innovative.
When I first said supported and empowered, you picked up empowered and you said, yes, you feel empowered. Does that mean you do not feel supported by the Agency of Education or both?
No, well, I don't want to disparage the Agency of Education, but I don't feel particularly supported by them on a day-to-day basis, no. We do a lot of the work on our own. There's certainly some support, but it's not our innovative work, I feel like, is our innovative work. It's not discouraged, but it's not outwardly supported on a day-to-day basis by the Agency of Education.
So what would you like to see the Agency of Ed do so that all Vermont schools are able to feel this innovation and do what's best for students?
Well, I think the more you bring people together and the more you talk about ideas, I think that leads to innovation. One way that, I mean, I try to do that is through the Vermont Ed Chat that I started on Twitter 3 years ago. And every other Wednesday night, educators from around Vermont gather for an hour on Twitter. And we talk about creativity, innovation, collaboration on Twitter. And that spurs ideas, I think, amongst all of us. And I think really putting people together to talk about it is what makes a difference. I mean, that's what I found when I was at my first league meeting. You know, leaders were brought together and talked about innovation, thought about innovation, shared ideas about innovation. I don't know if we do that very much in Vermont. We certainly have meetings, but I don't know if they're generally focused on that topic.
Can students and parents lurk in on that Twitter chat?
Oh, absolutely. We have students sometimes who participate. People participate from all over the country, sometimes all over the world. You know, in Franklin West, we did something using Twitter to start the school year. We called it the 20-day Twitter challenge, where each day we had like a different question that people answered and shared ideas and shared resources. And, you know, it's a little piece of the puzzle, but you have to have more than one person thinking of an idea. You know, nobody's ever really thought of a great idea by themselves. Ideas are built by many people. You know, you asked that question about support from the Agency of Education. I wish there were some things that they could take off of the table of school so we didn't have to worry about it, so that we could free up resources to do other things.
Like what?
Each school district in Vermont, or each SU, figures out how to get internet into their schools on their own. You know, we all have different providers. You know, we contract with one company, someone else contracts with another. We contract with a company that's actually recommended by the Agency of Education, which I think is great, and they provide internet services for us. They provide a wide area network for us. And I think if we did that at a statewide level, we'd be able to free up resources across the state so we don't all do the same thing over and over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Act 46 talks about efficiencies. If we weren't worrying about internet, if the state at the agency level just provided internet to all the schools, I think that would go a long way to freeing up resources. I think if we had one common learning management system, pre-K through 12, that would be great. Eventually, all schools are going to have a learning management system. Some just may not know it yet, but eventually they all are going to have them. Every college has a learning management system. And just a way to deliver content and keep students and parents and teachers all on the same page digitally. But it's fairly new in the pre-K through 12 environment. So what's going to happen, at least what I think is going to happen, is that every school eventually is going to go it alone. And then we're going to have 20 or 30 different learning management systems out there. If the state really promoted one and said, this is going to be our learning management system, that would take it off the plate of schools and free up resources. Other states have done that. Delaware just did. I mean, lots of states do it. But we're really not even having that conversation yet, and I wish we would. So little things like that, or a student management system. We all have different student management systems, and that's the system where, you know, you keep parents' names and phone numbers and student information. And we all use different ones in the school, and we all pay for different ones, and we all pay for different trainings. So kind of the behind-the-scene pieces, the infrastructure, I wish was more consistent, and I think that would really help us.
Well, Ned, thanks for telling us about your district, your supervisory union, and about the league and your experience with it so far.
Great. Thank you.
That's Ned Kirsch, superintendent of Franklin West Supervisory Union in northwestern Vermont. Franklin West is the only school district in New England to have been accepted into the League of Innovative Schools. We have more details at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. This past Monday on Vermont Edition, we asked you for ideas of laws you would enact in Vermont if you could. We had a ton of listener suggestions, and here to share some of them and other messages to the show is executive producer Patty Daniels. Hi, Patty.
Hey, Jane. Let's start with Jake in Morrisville. He suggests, I'd like to see a law that imposes a significant tax on any water exported from Vermont. I think this underappreciated resource will become very valuable soon, and Vermont residents should benefit, not big companies.
Pat in Rutland wants to make the criminal court system take the enlightening studies about the nature of the teenage brain into account. Hint, Pat says, it's still developing, and we can't afford to pay the cost of incarcerating teens while their brains finish developing.
Here's Bill in Jericho. He says student loans should be allowed as a business expense as graduates move into the workplace.
And Ed requests this new law. I would like a statute that prohibits livestock from invading my private property.
And finally, a few of you, including Aylith in Middlebury, say, get rid of daylight saving time.
That brainstorm of potential new laws came out of our interview with Vermont Law School professor Oliver Goodenough. He's facilitating a 3-day workshop next week at the State House that offers a practical crash course in how policy and laws are made. The event is called a Legathon, and the organizers are hoping to generate actual policy proposals for lawmakers to consider. Again, you can find more information and how to participate at vpr.net/Vermont Edition.
Okay, here's a few other messages to the show this week. We heard from librarian Mary Wunderlich at Thedford Elementary School. And she wrote in response to Dorothy's List. That's our monthly reading series for kids. It's based on the books that are nominated for the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Award. Mary says, our sixth grade students recently listened to today's broadcast. We met in our school library for lunch and we enjoyed eating and listening to Vermont Edition. All of our sixth graders are reading Steve Shankin's The Port Chicago 50 as a class read aloud. And the students were wondering if you've chosen all of your school sites for this year's Dorothy's List. We are K through 6, public elementary school, and many of our students read DCF books all year long.
Sadly, Mary, we have chosen all of this year's participants. However, there's still a way to participate online. Go to vpr.net/Dorothy's List and you'll find a robust community of students, educators, and parents who are reading and discussing the books nominated for this year's Dorothy Canfield Fisher Award. We would love to see you and your students participate with us online. That's at vpr.net/Dorothy's List.
And finally, our recent interview with Pamela Paquin raised a few eyebrows. She is a fashion designer who uses roadkill to create high-end fur clothing and accessories. Holly was not impressed. "This is wrong to encourage people to wear fur from any source," says Holly. "People need to drive more carefully, and there needs to be some kind of critter bridge for animals to cross roads."
Well, RS in Jamaica had a different reaction and writes, "Holy cow, now that's a good laugh. This whole interview sounds like a long comic piece, a Portlandia-like riff. Good golly, the layers of ridiculousness. Thanks for the laugh."
Okay, if you are outraged or entertained, we would love to hear your reaction to Vermont Edition. Connect with us on Facebook or Twitter. Email us, vermontedition@vpr.net. We'd love to hear from you.
Thanks, Patty.
You're welcome.
Tomorrow, we'll talk about the latest on the state's struggle with heroin. Law enforcement tells us that more heroin is entering the state than before and that the trend is increasing. We'll look at the drug trade and the dangerous links to sex trafficking. Send your questions or comments to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen live tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening today.